Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, the theme for this afternoon's talk is if you get it wrong, never mind. So I thought it was a very useful theme, an area of that touches everybody's lives, because this is talking about the role of success and failure. So whether that's inside the monastic life, outside the monastic life, in the secular world, in the world of the kindergarten or the Houses of Parliament or the hospital or the university or in the on the retirement ward, it pertains. These are significant issues everywhere in our lives and for everybody. So I thought this was an interesting theme to explore, to look at, to see how we relate to these qualities, the feeling of rightness and wrongness, success and failure, and so forth. Particularly because success and failure in our lives, not just in the Western world, but in the in terms of much of human life on the planet, the succeeding is taken as an absolute good, and failure is taken as something absolutely awful. And because of the strength of that currency, the importance that we give them, these do have a very powerful impact on our lives. And if we don't understand how that works, or don't consider how those qualities work, then we're just pulled around, blown around by the forces of success and failure, and that these have an undue influence over our lives. When I was seeing the title and reflecting on this, I was immediately reminded of a couple of talks that a man called Trevor Leggett, who some of you might have heard of, maybe you have met in years gone by, is this very wonderful Buddhist teacher and writer. And he used to be in Japan. I think he used to look after much of the British, the BBC World Service productions in Japan for many years. And I met him a long time ago when he was giving talks at the Buddhist Society Summer School. Back in the early 80s, Lungpa Sumedho took me along to those a couple of times, back in 1980 or 81, 82. So one of the stories, Trevor Leggett always used to give his teachings based on little anecdotes and stories. And one of them that he told was that he was one of the most highly qualified judo experts. He was probably the most, in his era, the most highly qualified Westerner in Japan. He had something like a ninth dan judo black belt, and which was way above any other foreigner had ever achieved. So he's very much immersed in Japanese culture. But he said that when he first met his teacher of judo, the first thing that the teacher said, "Well, if you want me to take you on as a student, the first thing you have to do is to go into a monastery, a Zen monastery, and spend 3 months in retreat there." And up to this point, Trevor Leggett had no particular interest in Buddhism or meditation, but he was really interested in judo, and he was very impressed by the way that this teacher had sort of succeeded. And one of the things was, he said that his technique wasn't very good. I went along to many of these judo competitions, and this guy, he looked kind of scruffy and disorganized, and not as impressive as some of the other people who had come into the dojo. And you think, whoa, this is a real powerful fighter. And this fellow would sort of shamble in and didn't look very impressive, but he always won. And oftentimes you couldn't tell exactly how he won, but he always won. And so he said, up until that point, I've been trying to develop my technique, and I saw that most people who were successful had some particular trick, some particular device that they would use, and they would perfect that, and that would serve them in good stead. They would master that particular technique, that method, and that would be what took them to the top. But this one other fellow, he said, he didn't seem to have any particular technique. He didn't seem to have any kind of special policy, and yet he always came out on top. He always seemed to win. So I thought, I want to learn from him. So that when he approached him, the first thing that this teacher had said was, I'm not sure about taking on foreigners, you know. It's a bit of a tall order. But, you know, if you want to be my student, the first thing you have to do is to go and study in a Zen monastery. So, what about the training? What about the exercises? No, forget all of that. Forget judo. Just go into the Zen monastery and watch your mind for the next 3 months. So Trevor Leggett was so impressed by this fellow and thought, well, this is a novel approach, so maybe I'll give it a try. So he took that on, and he said, while he's in the monastery, I forget exactly which temple it was, but a Zen temple in Kyoto, I believe, it had this very famous old rock garden with many, many different kinds of moss. It was one of these places famed for having sort of 700 years of gardeners looking after the mosses and tending them carefully and looking after them, you know, with great precision and care. And so by the time it was the story occurred, it was getting towards autumn. He'd been there a couple of months, and he was very, very focused on his Zen practice and being ever so mindful and thorough about everything he did. And so he'd been given the task of helping to rake the moss garden. So this was like very serious business, that high honor to be able to help the gardener. And so he wanted to make sure he did it really correctly and was absolutely mindful and careful about how he did all the leaf raking. And so as the story went, as he told it, he was working away, bamboo rake, very, very carefully, mind fixed on the points of the rake as they picked up all the leaves and gathering the leaves together, taking them carefully off to one side, and ever so mindful and careful the whole time. And after 2 or 3 hours of this, he's just standing there with his rake thinking, pretty good job. Even if I say so myself, the whole place absolutely glistening, you know, the moss is completely sort of free of any sort of leaves and twigs and all sort of extraordinarily perfect and tidy. And then, as they always do in these stories, along comes the Zen master and walks up, and Trevor Leggett was saying, you know, at that point, I must confess, I did feel a certain expectation that he was going to say, nice job, Trevor, or, you know, the Japanese equivalent thereof. And but he looked around and he said, okay, well, he's gonna say it, how's he gonna put it? And then he looked and looked and looked and said, not quite perfect. And he's like, well, what did I miss? What did I miss? There's something, you know, I can't have missed anything. And he's looking around and seeing, did he leave a rock in the wrong place, or did he, you know, was there a twig that had fallen down? And so just next to him there was a small maple tree with the beautiful sort of scarlet-coloured leaves, and the Zen master kind of reached over to the trunk of this maple tree, gave it a shake, and then 4 or 5 leaves came down and landed on the moss. He says, now it's perfect. So he developed that theme of saying that, you know, 80% is perfect, 100% is bad taste. That, you know, in that respect, that sense of the mind's idea of what is perfect or what is right is not always exactly in tune, and that was a powerful lesson for him, that he could see that along with his sort of his great effort, there was also a certain amount of pride and also a certain amount of presumption about sort of what sort of perfect or right was, and that he certainly made it very tidy, but he'd also been missing the larger picture. Another of the stories that he told was that it was really, it always stuck in my mind, was that during that era, he had made the acquaintance of somebody, an English teacher who had been employed in the Japanese royal household to be a tutor to the an English tutor to the princes of the royal house. And Trevor was asking what it was like to be in that, you know, very very formalized and sort of strictly hierarchical situation, and having that role as a teacher for these princes who are supposed to be, you know, the descendants of the sun god, you know, very very sort of exalted in the eyes of Japanese society. And then he said the thing that struck him most was that this English teacher had said, "Well, I see that the most important job for me is to teach these boys how to fail." Says because they're in such a privileged position, and everything is so filled with expectation for them, that I feel it's important for me to help them to learn how to fail, because this is one of the most important things in life. And that always stayed with me. That really struck me as something very important, because it's not that we are ever aiming to fail or failing on purpose, but just to understand the dynamics of the hope for success, the fear of failure, how we frame the things that we do in those parameters, and how much we create suffering for ourselves out of wanting success, fearing failure, and then when we get success, how we relish it and get excited about it, and how when things fail, then we feel it as a disaster, and we experience terrible dejection and loss and misery. So in that instance, he said he felt that it was his job to teach those kids how to fail, how to learn to make mistakes, to not be perfect, even though they might be the descendants of the sun god and the inheritors of the Japanese throne to become, you know, the emperor and so forth. That to be able to learn how to not be perfect, and to see that that's not the end of the world, or that that is something that is an intrinsic part of life. So I thought it was kind of English, interesting that an English guy was so trying to convey this principle in Japan. But I felt this is such a significant issue, because for myself, I've always been very much motivated by fear of failure and a desire for success, and that when you succeed, you take that to be something that is indeed intrinsically wonderful. And when you fail, then it's the end of the world. So that that simple phrase, teaching them how to fail, something that stuck in my mind. I thought, oh, that's an interesting concept. In the Buddha's teachings on this area, this whole area is often referred to as the loka dhammas, so the worldly dhammas. And the Buddha defined these in eight particular dimensions, so as four pairs of qualities. So these are happiness and unhappiness, praise and criticism, or praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and gain and loss. So these are sometimes called the eight worldly winds, or the eight loka dhammas, the worldly dhammas. And so these are the forces of our lives. You know, this is common to everybody. You know, gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness, fame and disrepute, and praise and criticism. That these are in all of our lives. We experience these to a greater or lesser extent. And the Buddha pointed out how when the mind is focused on worldly attitudes and is taken up with self-centered thinking and those habits, then when we get praised, then we get elated and carried away. When we experience gain or happiness, when we are praised, then, you know, everything is wonderful about the world, isn't it? It's kind of the sun comes out and hooray, what a wonderful day, you know. We rejoice and celebrate, and we get elated. And then when we experience criticism, when we're blamed, when we're criticized, when we experience loss, when we experience unhappiness, then just even those words like, you know, loss, blame, you can feel your heart sink just hearing the words, right? The Buddha said pointed out how when we're the worldly mind will always feel sort of dejected and lost and bereft when experiencing those qualities. But the wise, noble disciple, when there's wisdom, when we see things with wisdom, then in contrast, when we're praised or when we experience gain or happiness and when we are famous or sort of highly regarded, then we don't get carried away by that. You recognize, well, this is just, this is one of those things that, that happens in life. There's things that sometimes there's good fortune and things go well, and it's a sweet taste, okay? Sweet tastes are impermanent and they don't last forever. They're not totally satisfactory. And similarly, when things fall apart, when things are bitter and difficult, when we experience loss, and similarly, we don't get dejected, but more recognize, oh, well, this is just part of the whole the pattern of living, that there's the bitterness of loss, of criticism, of being rejected. It's a bitter taste. That's all. It's not such a huge thing. So that there's an evenness of heart, an evenness of understanding. And so we're not blown around by those worldly winds. Now the question is, so how do we learn how to not get carried away, not to get drunk on praise and gain and those experiences of approval, or what we find as sweet or delightful experiences, and how do we save ourselves from becoming dejected and lost when we're criticized or blamed? And this is in a way is the most sort of interesting or important part of the issue. Because in a sense it's so deeply ingrained in us that we so much want success and we so fear failure that we assume that they are absolute qualities, that if something is good, it's an absolute good, it's always that way, and if it's a good thing, then it's completely desirable, and if we're right, then it's an absolute rightness, or if something is wrong, then it's absolutely wrong, and that we don't notice how we pick up rightness and wrongness. So this is the first thing I thought that is useful for us to recognize, to see how does our mind hold being right, being wrong? How does our mind hold success and failure? What do we do when we experience those things? How does it sit within our hearts? Because we can be right about something and make a terrible mess of it, right? and we can experience wrongness, and it can be something that's useful to us, and that it's by taking these as absolute values that we cause the most trouble. One of the things I've mentioned a few times in these talks is how when we succeed at something, or something say some very pleasant event in our life, something that we've been looking forward to, you get a promotion at work, or you get married to someone that you've been together with for a long time, or you finally get to buy the house that you've been wanting to have for so many years, or you move to the country, like you try to get to move to your new country, and finally you got your visa, the wedding's on, you got your house, you got the promotion, and you think, oh, fantastic, this is so great, I'm so happy at last. I'm going to get married, or I'm going to get into the monastery, or I'm going to get to move to the new country. I'm getting the promotion. I got the new job, and we rejoice. We celebrate. How wonderful! The success, passed the exam. Won the prize. Got the award. Got named the winner, and we are rejoicing. I think all of us have had some kind of experiences of prize winning or passing exams or approval, right? Yeah. Maybe someone here is thinking, not me. But I would, as just in sheer terms of statistics, I'd say there's likely that most of us have had that experience in some way, shape, or form during our life. And then, so then we rejoice and we think, how wonderful, how incredible, how marvelous. And then 5 years later, we're thinking, I can't believe that I was rejoicing about that. How could I not have seen what was going to come with it? When I got the promotion, how could I have not noticed that I was actually going to have to do there's going to be more responsibility that came with it? Or that when I got the new house, how could I have forgotten about the people I was going to be living next door to? you know. Oh, right. Oh, if I'm going to move to England, you've got to live with English people. Oh, right. Oh, my children are going to grow up English. They're not going to be... Oh, dear. I didn't bargain on that. No. So then we then can look back at those things that we were celebrating and feeling so delighted about and thinking, that's the worst thing that ever happened to me was getting that promotion or winning that prize or getting that... Getting that kind of thing that I was so desirous of. And on the other hand, the other end of the spectrum, there can be things in our lives that we feel are incredibly undesirable, getting fired from that job, that marriage breaking up, or failing that exam, things falling apart. Some project that you put a huge amount of effort and heart into, going pear-shaped and not working and ending up with a huge loss of face and a big debt. And at the time you think, oh, this is terrible, this is awful, this is disastrous. Or having some life-threatening illness or some kind of loss in our life. Someone close to us passes away and someone dear to us dies. And we feel this is the most terrible, awful thing to have happened, and this is a disaster. And then a few years later, you realize, well, it might sound crazy, but that's actually the best thing that ever happened to me, was that getting thrown out of that job or that project collapsing or having that loved one pass away. There's so much, so many good qualities or so many lessons were learned from that would never have been learned otherwise. So what we begin to see is that it's a mistake to take successes and failures, rights and wrongs, as absolutes, and begin to see that within every right there's some wrong, within every wrong there's some right. And so much of it depends on how we handle it, how we pick up those experiences of our life and how we name them, how we frame them. One of the other stories that comes to mind that Lumpur Sumedho often tells is how when he was a young monk in his early years with Ajahn Chah, there was another bhikkhu who came to join the monastery. He hadn't originally been a student of Ajahn Chah's, but came along after some time. He'd already been a monk for a few years, and he was very unusual, sort of eccentric and extremely... loud-mouthed character, which is very unusual in Thailand. Usually people are quite, especially in the monastic sphere, that you're very contained and modest and quiet. This particular fellow was really noisy and raucous and opinionated and spoke very loudly and belligerently to everybody. And so he was a new person. He'd just shown up and he was staying in the monastery, and Ajahn Chah had accepted him to stay there. And during these months, then the young Ajahn Sumedho was getting more and more indignant. Like, how can he behave like that? Why doesn't anybody do anything? We can grumble with the other monks down at the dyeing shed when we're washing our robes and sort of complain about how loud-mouthed and obnoxious and difficult this other monk is. But why doesn't Ajahn Chah kind of scold him? Or why doesn't anybody sort of straighten him out? There's something should be done about this. And grumble, grumble, grumble. And so that he sort of stored up this his pet peeve, kind of gathered his resentments, and he kept waiting for Ajahn Chah to say something. And even times when Ajahn Chah was right there and this monk would be sort of speaking to him very loudly and sort of really inappropriately and kind of using the really coarse language and speaking very noisily and seemingly being obviously very disruptive, it's like, why doesn't Ajahn Chah put him in his place? Why, he should scold him or at least make some sort of comment. He's not doing anything. This isn't right. So eventually he waited till Ajahn Chah was away for a little while. And every 2 weeks we have the recitation of the monastic rule, the Patimokkha. It's a very formal ceremony, and oftentimes after the recitation is over, it takes about 45 minutes to do the chanting. And then if there's any Sangha business needs to be discussed, then it's brought up at that time. I guess Ajahn Liam was the senior monk then. Ajahn Chah was away, so he said, "Is there anything that to discuss amongst the Sangha. And the young Sumato Bhikkhu said, actually, yes, there's something I'd like to bring up. Even though he was quite junior, and he was junior to this monk with the noisy monk, he said, I'd like to bring up something. This is a delicate issue, but I feel it's very important for harmony in the Sangha, and you know, I'd like to bring up certain points about monk X's behavior. And he had all of his names and dates and facts all sort of lined up. He had his script prepared, and so all the things that were wrong and out, you know, this monk was doing that were out of order, and so he went through them one by one, and this monk was sitting there very pointedly looking at the mat with great and rising embarrassment, and the other monks were probably also looking. Yeah, around the hall, it's not quite sure. Well, the righteously indignant young Sumato just carried on with his list of complaints and criticisms. And so when he got to the end of that, then he said, I'd like to offer this for people's consideration. And so may the Sangha act accordingly. And so then I imagine Lumpur Liam said something like, well, yes, okay, thank you, we heard what you have to say, and this obviously will need to be brought up with Lumpur Cha when he gets back from his travels, and so let's just wait until then and see what Lumpur has to say. And so then he had kind of expected some of the other monks to come up to him and say, well done, Sumato, you really let him have it, you know, nice work. He's had that coming to him, and, you know, as might have happened in America or in a more sort of Western circumstance, but... it seemed like other people sort of didn't bring up the issue or tended to avoid him, and so he thought, oh, well, never mind, but at least it's out in the open now, and you know, at least it's been said, and it can be properly addressed by Lumpur when he gets back. So to his surprise, then within a couple of days, this monk after the meeting looked extremely sort of embarrassed and sheepish and humiliated, and he didn't talk to anybody, and he was noticeably quiet. And then after a day or two, he disappeared. You know, he just sort of packed up his bowl and robes and had gone, just left the monastery, and no one knew where he'd gone. So then after a couple of weeks, Lumpur Cha came back, and of course, you know, word very quickly reached him of this whole incident, and so a little while later, then he found a quiet moment and asked Lumpur Sumato to, you know, to come over and have a chat. and he said, you know, Sumato, what you said to that monk, that was really inappropriate. He says, you know, of course everybody knew that he has a terrible mouth. The expression in Thai was that he used was bark bark bap. Meaning his mouth is evil, bark bark, there jai di. But his heart is good. His mouth is evil, but his heart is good. And so you speaking him to like that, you shamed him publicly, you embarrassed him. And you know, do you think that I was really unaware of how he spoke and acted? You think I'm that stupid? Yeah, of course everyone knew how awful his speech habits are, but. You know, Wat Bopong, and you realize, of course, that he's been thrown out of every other monastery he's ever stayed in because no one could tolerate him. But this was, Wat Bopong was one place he could stay because I was making space for him. But now you shut the door on him because of the way you've spoken. So that, you've now made it impossible for him to live here at Wat Bopong. So you have to accept the fault, Sumato, he's run away and he can't come back here, and what will happen to him I don't know, but it's your responsibility, it's your error, your mistake that he's run off and that you've closed the door on him, because this was one of the few, he did have good qualities and this was one of the few places he could practice, but now he can't do that because you've the way you acted in relationship to him, so you should acknowledge that and bear it in mind. And then the thing that he said that I found most significant, and that you know, Lumpur Sumato would often stress when he told this story, is that he said, you were correct, you were right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. This is a phrase to remember. You are right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. So that yes, all the things that you said that he said, they were true. And that, yes, his his behavior was disruptive, and that his speech was coarse and often inappropriate and out of place. But you were, and so that you were correct in your facts, but you were wrong in terms of how to approach that. That in terms of Dhamma, in terms of what was actually going to be helpful to him and to you and to the whole community, then you were definitely off key, off balance. And so that's a very, very, very important principle. And I think in terms of our own lives and of the greater world, this is something to really take to heart. Also, rather like Trevor Leggett in the rather more mild example of the tree, you know, with the maple leaves. That, yes, you're right. In fact, but you know, in terms of Dhamma, it's not quite in tune with things, and that we can so easily be that way in our life, that we can the criticisms that we can have about each other and about the world, we can say stack up the whole list of things that the way it should be and our reasonable complaints, but then we take those reasonable complaints. And often about very wholesome or noble issues, and then the way that we pick them up and handle them can be extremely ignoble. That also Ajahn Chah would use the expression like it's like having a club with the word metta written on it, you know, like you're kind of pounding people with your metta, that you're like. You have this idea that you're spreading loving kindness, or you're being kind to them, but what you're really doing is like saying, "Shut up, sit still, be quiet, and you know, leave me alone." And but what you're saying is, "May you be happy, you know, may you be peaceful, you know." And I want to do this. You know, I have your best interests at heart. And so that this is such a common issue in our lives and in the world, that the content of our discussions or what we're talking about can seem to be very high-minded or very polite, but what's going on underneath it can be very say selfish or childish or driven by fear and greed and aversion. Yeah. So that sense of we might be say. Talking about how to run the hospital or to say the precise treatment of a particular patient, and you're talking about sort of refined details of some sort of medical procedure. But what you're actually saying is, you're a fool. I'm in charge. You know, I'm the top dog here. You shut up and lie down and behave yourself. Otherwise, I'll rip your head off. You don't say that on the surface level. You say, "Well, I don't think that's quite the appropriate treatment here." But that's what is meant. It's more like on the surface, it can be very sort of polished and refined and seemingly sophisticated. But underneath, it can easily be like a fight between 8-year-olds in the playground. So this is a very common condition, at least I find. Even in monasteries, this can happen. So much then depends on how we relate to rightness and wrongness, and how, when we look at the feeling of being right, how we handle that, or we look at the feeling of being wrong, because that sense of wrongness, of things being out of balance, that can also be something that we can make a great deal of trouble out of it, but also it can be something that is beneficial to us. We can use that feeling of wrongness in a beneficial way. But the most important thing is to see how our habitual reactions form around those experiences of being right, being wrong, and learning how to not be pulled, swayed by that. One of again going back to Japan, this is from the Zen tradition, but it's from the Chinese, the third patriarch of Zen Buddhism, who was in China, Sengtsan. One of the most famous scriptures out of the Far East, Buddhist scriptures, is called the Verses of the Faith on the Faith Mind, the Sin Sin Ming. It's the Sutra that begins, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." Some, many of you might have heard this. Well, towards the end of that particular work, it's a very brief sutra that was written by the third Zen patriarch, Sengtsan. There's a little passage that says, "One thing, all things, move among and intermingle without distinction. To dwell in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. So that, obviously that you could do a whole week on the commentary on the Sin Sin Ming, but this particular passage really came to mind because, again, when looking at this area, because I found for myself that, like I was mentioning earlier, I found myself very, very motivated by the desire for success, the fear of failure, and fixating on the way that things should be right, and when things are wrong, and taking that very personally, or getting very worried, getting very anxious about things being incorrect or done or badly said or done in the wrong way. And that this single line about to dwell in this realization, like say to learn how to have a more even attitude towards the worldly dhammas of success and failure, praise and criticism, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and criticism, and so on. To dwell in that evenness of mind, as he phrases it, to dwell in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. And I remember that when I first looked at those words, it jumped off the page at me. Without anxiety about non-perfection. That's never even occurred to me as a concept. Because if something's imperfect, then you have to do something about it. You have to fix it, or you should at least worry about it, even if you can't fix it. That if something's not right, then you immediately have a relationship to that wrongness and think, no, it shouldn't be that way. That's not right. I've got to fix that, or someone's got to do something. It shouldn't be that way. And that sense of the possibility of being without anxiety about non-perfection, that was a kind of wonderful possibility that was lifted up. And also one of the things that is a part of it is that it's not a matter of just switching off and making the mind numb. We're not just anesthetizing ourselves to just ignore all experience or to stop feeling. But it's to do with letting go of that feeling of anxiety or that sense of it shouldn't be this way. Because one of the most important ways of understanding dukkha, this quality that the Buddha has talked about, is usually translated as suffering. Dukkha is more accurately that feeling of something is wrong with life, that it shouldn't be this way. Maybe our thinking mind doesn't spell it out like that, but it's that feeling of this isn't fair, this isn't right, it's unfortunate that the world is this way, I wish it wasn't this way, I wish it was another way. And that tension in the heart of wanting things to be other than the way they are. And so that triggers this feeling of anxiety. And sense of wrongness. But is the most crucial about understanding dukkha is not a matter of making ourselves numb to it, but to recognize that feeling of wrongness. And that when we shift our view, when we apply the Buddha's teachings and steer the heart towards a quality of right view, right understanding, then there can still be that experience. It's still like the the things are untidy, or the voice is still annoying, or the work that we have before us still needs to be done, or there's an illness in the body that still needs to be treated. But that sense of wrongness, of the universe being out of joint, that feeling of it shouldn't be this way, that shifts, and so that there's a balancing. There's a way of things coming into alignment. And so when we say, if it's wrong, never mind, it doesn't mean, just I don't care, it's your problem, I'm out of here, or just I don't care, or I'm just going to get, just going to ignore it and be numb. It's not that kind of never mind. So when I'm looking at the title for the talk this afternoon, I thought, well, I hope they didn't think that it means how to switch off more effectively, how to numb the faculties completely. But it's not a matter of going numb or just switching off, which is what they call vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of, or the desire to not feel. But it's more to do with realigning the heart so that there's a sensitivity and attending to all things, there's an attending to that feeling of wrongness, that dukkha. But then, as the Buddha said in his very first teaching of the turning of the Dhamma wheel, that dukkha needs to be understood, it needs to be apprehended, it needs to be received. This is dukkha. And then recognizing that the cause of that dukkha, that feeling of disharmony, is because of self-centered desire. And when that self-centered desire, that tanha, is let go of, then there's alignment, there's things come into balance, and there's a quality of freedom. And so that doesn't mean to say that all our illnesses vanish, or all the difficult people in our office disappear, all our challenging family members suddenly become easygoing and helpful. It doesn't mean that, but it means that our heart doesn't turn them into a problem. We stop seeing things as intrinsically, you know, a problem or wrong, but more this recognizing these are patterns of nature. This is just the sweetness of success or the bitterness of failure. This is the sweetness of praise or the bitterness of criticism. That's all. They're just flavors. Nothing to get elated about, nothing to get dejected about. And there's an attunement that is there instead. So it's a lot to do with shifting the view, and in a way establishing right view is to do with that, you know, letting go of those self-centered concerns and seeing that what we experience as success or we experience as failure is very much a subjective point of view. And when we broaden the scope, we broaden the view in this way, then we open the possibility for that greater quality of alignment. Yeah, and another way of looking at this, or way of describing it, that comes to mind is to see how we tend to think of wanting to be, that we find happiness in life by getting the things that we like. Is that fair? Get the things you like and then you're happy, right? Is that a fair snapshot of how we tend to relate to life? Yeah, a few people nodding. Obviously I'm leading onto something, but yeah. It's the right thing to do is to nod here, that's right. You're supposed to agree with me at this point, right? So that's generally how we find happiness. We get the things that we like. When we get what we like, then we're happy. But then, of course, when we get the things that we like, then sometimes they disappoint us straight away, or sometimes then they disappoint us later on, and we just want the new version, or the upgrade, or the this year's model. And so that we find that trying to find happiness through getting the things that we like is an endless hunger, an endless state of lack that we're feeding. And so it's a shifting the view from trying to find happiness by getting what we like to instead finding happiness through liking what we get. Another easy thing to remember. So along with right in fact but wrong in Dhamma, here's another easy little Dhamma soundbite to learn how to like what we get rather than find happiness through liking what we get rather than getting what we like. And that's, in a way that that's pointing to is a quality of openness, that sense of recognizing whether I like it or not, here it is. Whether I want it to be this way or I don't want it to be this way, here it is. I'm also reminded of an incident when in the early years in Thailand, one of the monks who had extremely bad knees was receiving, he needed to have his knees operated on in Bangkok. And so he'd gone down from the northeast and was staying in the hospital there. And so what they would normally do is they'd do one knee first and then wait for that to heal and then do the other knee afterwards. And he had this idea, I don't want to spend all my time here in Bangkok, I want to get back to the forest, just do them both at once. Yes, precisely. Yeah. So the doctor said, well, Venerable Sir, I don't think that's a very good idea, but if that's what you want. Then, so of course, they went through with the surgery, and this monk was stuck in hospital and was in a very uncomfortable and somewhat dejected state of mind. So it just so happened Ajahn Chah had some event he had to go to in Bangkok, and he heard that this monk, one of the foreign monks, was in the hospital, so he went to go and see him. after this double knee surgery. And so he asked the fateful question, you know, how are you? And you know, sometimes when you ask somebody, how are you, they're not really expecting an entire thesis. But anyway, that was like opening the floodgate. And so he expressed how, you know, it was, you know, things weren't really going well, and it was really horrible being in the hospital, and his knees weren't recovering, and he couldn't really walk and couldn't do anything, couldn't do the exercises, and it wasn't going as it should do. And that was the main theme, was, you know, it shouldn't, the way it's going is not right, and it shouldn't be this way, it's not fair. And after he had finished his delivery, and sort of come to the end of what he was saying, then Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, if it shouldn't be this way, it wouldn't be this way. So we're not very big on kind of comforting. Sort of, it's the Buddhist approach towards comforting is through realism rather than consolation through, don't worry dear, everything will be all right. It's like, here it is. That's also a helpful thing. If it shouldn't be this way, it wouldn't be this way. It's like, well, here it is, you know. And that seeing that no matter what the causes are, it's up to us in this moment whether we make a problem out of this or not. It could be that it is, you know, maybe the surgeon did botch the operation, or maybe things could have been done differently. But here it is, right now, it's exactly like this. Which is not to say that there's some sort of fatalism, but... seeing that in each moment it's up to us as individuals whether we make a problem out of life or not. Even if we have been treated really unfairly, we've been arrested and thrown in jail and being badly treated, and against all the systems of justice. But even then, even if we are being improperly and illegally mishandled and badly treated, it's still up to us whether we make a problem out of it or not. It doesn't mean to say that you should just be totally passive, but whether we create suffering out of it is entirely our business. And so that that sense of wrongness in life, even though you've got a really good list of of good reasons why to complain, rather like Lumpur Sumedho and the monk with the mouth. It's like, yeah, even if you've got really good reasons to complain, the mind going into aversion and negativity and, say, that sense of berating the universe for being like it is, we're just creating more suffering for ourselves. And as the example that the Buddha gave, which is, I realize, very demanding standard, but he liked to use examples to get people's attention. He said, even if you've been captured by bandits, and they were sawing your arms and legs off with a two-handled saw. Right, okay, this is a pretty abusive situation, right? I mean, you've been kidnapped. You're having your arms and legs cut off with a two-handled saw. So the Buddha knew how to get our attention with these images. Okay, this is a completely undesirable situation and definitely unfair and shouldn't be this way. And he said, if you arouse a thought of negativity towards them on account of their actions, you are not carrying out my teaching. Even a thought. It's not even a word of complaint. Like, if you arouse a thought of negativity, of aversion towards them, then you're not carrying out my teaching. Rather, you should think, I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness. And so spreading loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity towards the people who are chopping your arms and legs off. And you might think, hey, come on. This is an Olympic standard Dhamma practice. But the Buddha did know how to get our attention, but also he's saying, look, this is how it is, that there's no such thing as reasonable hatred. That if your mind is going towards aversion or complaining or blaming the universe for being the shape it is, then you are intrinsically closing the door of your heart to the reality of things. So he knew that people were going to hear that. It was called the simile of the saw, that particular teaching. He knew that people were going to hear that and go, But what it does do is say, well, if you're not fulfilling his teaching, if you're giving rise to negativity, when someone's chopping, sawing your arms and legs off, then that feeling of negativity of the person who just moved your moved your chair in the office, you know. It's like that you want to, you know, you want to disembowel them because they, you know, they stole your desk, or that they, or even on a, even in a monastery, like they've moved your, someone's moved your meditation cushion, like, that's my mat. But you know, you can get extremely territorial even over your zafu, you know, your meditation cushion. So that just seeing that feeling of wrongness, and that and how we can take hold of that and say, you know, it shouldn't be this way. But then to develop the meditation and mindfulness to, and the qualities of attention, to recognize whenever that arises, whenever the mind goes into that, it shouldn't be this way or this is unfair, to recognize that and to see the mind creating dukkha around that. Now, all this doesn't mean, and again, I say this, make this point over and over in different situations and different teachings I can give, but this, to talk in this way, doesn't mean to say that we're encouraging being passive. It just means that we're learning how not to react to life from a place of compulsive action or self-centered reactivity, but we're instead learning to respond to life rather than react to it. So that to respond means that there's a quality of mindfulness, there's a receiving of the situation. And then what guides our actions then is an attunement to the situation, so that there's a response that comes from mindfulness and wisdom and kindness, rather than a reaction that's coming from wanting happiness, disliking pain, and righteous indignation and so forth. And one of the interesting things about speaking of the word rightness, because in the Eightfold Path that probably most of us are familiar with, you have this. This is like the main skeleton, the framework of the Buddha's teaching, the Eightfold Path: Samma Ditti, Samma Sankappa, Samma Vaccha, Samma Kammanto, and so forth. The Eightfold Path, and the Samma that is prefaces each of those words. Samma Ditti, Samma Sankappa, Samma Vaccha, Samma Kammanto, Samma Ajivo, and so on. That Samma is usually translated as right, so like right view, right resolution or right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. That the all those rights. And oftentimes people will see that Samma, that rightness, and assume it's sort of right as opposed to wrong. But it's that word Samma doesn't mean right so much in terms of right as opposed to wrong. It means right as in perfectly balanced. And it's interesting that the word Samma in that is related to a musical term, the Pali word Samma, which means attuned, like when you're tuning the strings of a veena, like a musical instrument, like a sitar, when you're tuning the strings to be harmonious with each other and to form a melodious chord, and to have the strings an equal tension, that so they are in harmony with each other. That's called Samma. That accord, that harmony between the strings is called Samma. I think that's got one M. The Samma, as in right, has got two M's, but it's they're closely related terms. So that right of right view, right intention, you know, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and so forth, of the Eightfold Path, that rightness is more to do with like being upright, being like right as in balanced, as opposed to right as opposed to wrong. And so it's talking about a quality of attunement. So view, which is attuned to reality, the intention or resolution that is attuned, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration, that is attuned to the Dhamma, that is in accord with reality. And so that, in a way, it gives us a somewhat different tone, you know, pun intended. It gives a different flavor, a different tone to the word. Now, when we're trying to find that mysterious quality of how to respond to life rather than react, how we relate to wrongness, it's not, as I said, it's to say never mind when if you get it wrong, never mind. It's not just to say, oh well, if I make a mistake and I upset you, well, that's your problem. You know, I don't care, or like I'm not going to pay for it, or that just sort of switching off or rejecting it or not taking responsibility. It's not that quality at all, but it's more to do with how to attune the heart to the present moment and how to find that way of, say, working with the experiences of life. Because over and over again, you know, in any one moment, we're always meeting with things that are not quite right,
right?
On smaller and larger scales. Liking things that are said in Dhamma talks, disliking things that are said in Dhamma talks, liking the seat that you've got, disliking the seat that you haven't got, for the talk or the different qualities of experience. We're all the time we're experiencing what we like and what we dislike, what we feel is right and what is wrong. So it's not a matter of compulsively trying to change it to get what we like, and it's not a matter of just switching off and not feeling, which you could put in the categories of two of the causes of suffering, bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. Rather, it's to do with learning how to attune the heart to the middle way. So right effort in our practice, samma vayamo, is very much what this is about. So that the Buddha defined right effort as restraining the unwholesome from arising, or if the unwholesome has arisen, letting it go, cultivating the wholesome and whatever wholesomeness that has arisen, maintaining it in being. So that right effort, there's a lot of doing in there. That this is how we train the heart to respond. But it's learning how to do those letting go and restraining the unwholesome, or cultivating and maintaining the wholesome. It's how we do that, but from a place of selflessness, not doing that from a base of self-view, but more that being guided by wisdom and mindfulness, satipanya. One of the last thing to share, as I see, mindfulness tells me that it's just before 3 o'clock, so Lada will be coming. I predict Lada will be coming through that door very shortly with some chai. Some years ago, there's a friend of ours who was one of the lay ministers associated with the monastery in California, where I was the last 15 years, up to last summer. That's where I was living for the last 15 years. He was a teacher of Buddhist, not just Buddhist meditation, but also he taught shiatsu and different kinds of bodywork. He had his own particular method of sort of Buddhist shiatsu that was called Insight Bodhi Work, Bodhi, Bodhi Work, yeah. California. They can't. That's what happens over there. You always have to have a little sort of niche. But anyway, he was a very gifted teacher, and he died a few years ago from bowel cancer. During that time, after he died, or just before he died, we got a very interesting, wonderful letter from someone who was a student of his. And she said how she was sorry she couldn't come to his funeral because she was living off in Taiwan, but she wanted to send this message. And she told this story of how when she'd been his student, there were three principles that he had stressed over and over again in terms of how to work with people to do body work, to do massage on them, to do sort of healing touch and so forth. And the three principles were: don't push, just use the weight of your own body. Don't diagnose, just be aware. Don't try to help, but don't turn away. So you might think this all sounds very paradoxical. But this, in a way, I felt this conveys very accurately that a lot of the principles that are needed. So don't push, just use the weight of your own body. So you're engaged, but it's not me trying to do something. Because when we approach things from a worldly perspective, it'll be, I see you've got a problem there. Let me jump in and fix it. So when we come at things from a reactive, worldly perspective, we want to jump in and fix things. Rather than, in a sense, just attune the mind to the situation and let the universe adjust, because this is a self-adjusting universe. If we pay attention and just let the self-based habits get out the way, then, in this sort of respect, the hands know what to do. The words that we need to say come to us. And I'll just finish with this little story that she told, how she said that one time she was on the very first meditation retreat she did, this 10-day retreat, and she was utterly despondent. And she went into the dining room of the retreat center, sat down in the furthest corner, had her breakfast sitting in front of her, and just cried into it. And she just wanted to be left alone and for nothing to bother her. And she just wanted to be miserable by herself. And then our friend Kandanya, who was the fellow who died, who'd been her teacher, she said that Kandanya came up and just sat down next to her. And it was a retreat, they're keeping noble silence, so he wasn't going to say anything anyway. But he came up and he just sat down next to her with his breakfast. He just started eating his breakfast. He said, he didn't look at me. He didn't make any kind of sign or signal or sort of, oh, how are you? But he was just there. And he just sat down, he was there, and he just ate his breakfast. And she said that was so helpful and so comforting that it just helped me to turn a real corner. A few years later, her younger sister was about to give birth to her first child. And this woman, Rachel, had been preparing for this for a long time. She'd gone to do midwifery courses and was going to be like a birth assistant for her sister. And so when she went into labor, her sister was just in this intense experience of pain, and she was screaming and screaming and screaming and wouldn't let anybody touch her. And so first of all, Rachel thinks, oh dear, I'm supposed to be the one who's helping her here, and what about the midwife and what's she doing? And then she realized, hang on a minute, I'm just bringing more attention to this. So, and her sister wouldn't let anyone go near her, wouldn't let anyone touch her. So Rachel just went, she said, I just went and sat down at the foot of the bed and just stayed there. Didn't try to talk to her, didn't try and do anything, didn't try to interfere, and just was there listening to her screaming. And then slowly things sort of abated, and eventually she gave birth to the child quite successfully and easily. And then afterwards, her younger sister said to her, you don't know how helpful that was when you came and you just sat down. Everyone else was fussing around in this panic, and I was in a bit of a state. I was screaming, and yeah, it was pretty wild pain. But that was so helpful that you just came and sat there and didn't try to do anything, but you were there. And then the last thing Rachel said was, "And now I'm with my sister. She's holding her cranky 2-year-old who's crying and crying and crying, and my sister is just." Holding her, holding the child, and being present as the child is in the state of dukkha. And I see Kandanya's work carrying on through the generations. So I thought that was these are very helpful principles to bear in mind, especially when we see something wrong, we want to jump in and fix. That to take those three principles, don't push, just use the weight of your own body. Don't diagnose, and doctors, if you have to do diagnosis for your profession, then, adapt accordingly, but don't diagnose. But don't diagnose, but just be aware. Don't try to help, but don't turn away. And then just allow the your own system, your own intelligence, your own natural attunement and your own participation in the natural order to be to let the response come forth from that, and then you'll find, to your amazement, I would predict, that your words and your actions are far more in tune and far more helpful than they could ever be if it was kind of me fixing it, me making it all right. So on that note, before the tea gets cold, I will offer these thoughts for consideration, and we can pause for about 20 minutes and have a cuppa, and then reconvene about 25 past.